Hello, everyone, and welcome to Let's Take a Stab at It. I'm your host, John Hoyer, and with me, as always, is...
Jason Bartsch, and we are keeping up our streak of nepotism on this show, and John's sister is back on with us.
Hi, Lauren Davis. If I'm correct, I am kind of bookending this whole series. Wasn't I your first guest, and now I'm the last one before your big finale?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, teacher has to explain things to us.
It's in her nature.
I'm always right, though. I always have the answer. So.
So the last time Lauren was on, John always talks about how much you roasted me, Lauren, in that episode. And he won't let me live it down. I mean, I remember you getting jabs in. I don't know. I don't listen to the show. I haven't heard it, but.
Or are you so.
Oh, he's so busy.
Or are you so traumatized by what happened the last time you've blocked it out?
That might be it. But that episode is the proudest that John has ever been.
Of me, probably.
Of anyone. And of you, like in your whole life, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Eat shit, Jason. What up? So, yeah, we got Lauren back. We're reviewing Freaky this week. And what better person to go with than a young teacher of sorts here. And, you know, of sorts.
She's not a real teacher, but she's not... like, what does that mean?
I don't know. No comment.
John, do you consider under a certain grade, like, not a real, like, what is your hierarchy of teacher status here?
Of sorts.
Well, she's a high school teacher, so I don't know if you could get, like, I mean, that's pretty, you know, you're dealing with, like, more, you know, developed minds. So
I'm not really teaching. I'm just kind of facilitating.
No, I'm saying the opposite, that it's harder.
Oh, okay.
When you're
Why don't you just try to walk back on it?
Okay.
Just take that foot and just keep pushing it further in your mouth.
John, what I hear is you're saying she's a glorified babysitter. That's what I heard you say.
No, that's not what I'm saying. No. let me step in, though. I will say I do think it's harder to be a high school teacher than, like, you know, if you're a third grade teacher. Like, you can make up division rules and they wouldn't know. They don't know. Whereas Lauren has to, you know, she gets questioned all the time about everything.
What grade do you actually teach, Lauren?
10th and 11th grade.
Trying to think of myself in that era. No, I was a good student. I would have been easy.
Well, I can't imagine you ever being like a little hellion or something. I was a bit of a handful when I was younger, so.
When you were younger?
still, I'm still a bit of a handful. What a great start to this episode. Okay. Enough bantering. Okay, let's move on. Lauren, what have you been watching this week?
So I watched the whole Conjuring trilogy in one weekend. That was probably intense and unnecessary. we are recording this a little bit earlier than when it's being released, so I should have been grading all of my students' fourth marking period stuff for the end of the school year. But I was like, you know what sounds better? Being possessed by demons and ghosts and all that stuff and being haunted. So I'd rather do that than grade your writing. I really liked the first one. Second one was
Yeah.
And then I really liked the third one too. I'm fascinated by the satanic panic, even though it's all, from what I can tell, is kind of made up, but still sort of interesting. The one thing that I was really surprised about is I didn't know that they're based on real people.
And there's like varying degrees of, like, people that watch the movies are like, there are some people apparently very invested in those, like, those real people, the Warrens' lives or something. Mm-hmm. Like, in the theater, I like ran into like some people that were like talking about, like, oh, I can't believe they showed this thing. And I'd be like it's some sort of like Marvel adaptation or something. Like, oh, that's a deep cut. And I was like, I don't care.
Right. Cause I watched most of the first one being like, this is a cool story. Like, that they came up with some interesting ideas. And then I was like, wait, didn't they say this was based on a real story or a true story at the beginning?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, oh, so they, okay.
Well, Fargo ruined it because they said it was based on a true story, yeah. And everyone knows that's fake. So then it's like everyone can just say that now, and it's like, you know, whatever. Who knows?
Right.
I mean, it can be used very loosely. Like, and don't even get started with inspired by a true story, because that could be like anything. Like, I could be inspired by something to do something else. Like, I could be inspired. Yeah. By something to do the opposite of that, and I'm still inspired by it.
So the movie The Strangers, that movie was inspired by true events. The true event was that, like, I think it was the director was somewhere, and then someone knocked on his door, and then the person acted like really weird with him. So then he like, okay, closed the door, and that was the end of the story. So that was the inspiration for the true events, was that incident. And I was like, wait, I don't know if that really counts, man. I'm sorry, but like, you're kind of full of shit. I don't know. But yeah, Lawrence, you'd recommend the Conjuring movies?
Yes. I have not seen anything outside of those three. I think you said you saw the first two.
I thought there were more than three. Are there?
Yeah, so there's like a whole Conjuring universe of like three Annabelles and a Nun movie, and there's something else I can't remember. Most of them are not
the
very
Nun
good.
Is a Conjuring thing too?
Yes. Yeah,
isn't that supposed to be like really bad?
Yeah. The Nun is it shows up in like, I think what, like one or two scenes at the beginning of Conjuring 2.
Yeah.
Then everyone was like, hey, that was kind of creepy. So they're like, let's make a movie about it. And it apparently wasn't that good. All right. Well, Jason, what have you been watching this week?
So last weekend, I had a lot of work to do around the house and a lot of errands to run. So naturally, I just sat on my couch and watched Captain Phillips on TNT or whatever. But
you're such a dad already.
I try to remind my friends when possible. I try to send out an annual reminder that Captain Phillips is an underrated movie and one of Tom Hanks' best performances. And it's about Somalian pirates that hijack a cargo ship. And it's just so well done. And Paul Greengrass directed. And I know that I was texting John about it when I was watching it, because I always champion this movie. But Tom Hanks just does such a great job of playing like an ordinary guy who is clearly like, you know, confident and prepared for something like this, but still like freaking out the whole time.
Yeah.
He like, there's a sense of calmness even throughout all of this, and he just pulls it off flawlessly. And I don't know. I think it's an underrated performance. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, he's so competent at his job that like, it's like he handles things better than most people would. But like, you see him like uneasy about where, you know, what does he have to do? And you're like, oh my God, he could do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And he thinks of everything so like logically and practically. And there's never this moment where he becomes like this Jason Bourne character and he's just like this unbelievable badass. You know, he just like he remains in this character the whole time, which
it's,
you know,
it's not like he's like, let me kill this guy with a book. that's a great movie. I think it's very underrated.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I looked it up after. He wasn't even like nominated for his performance in it, which I thought was surprising.
But, yeah, I think people talked about that when the Oscar nominations came out, that it was like a huge snub for Tom Hanks. I think it's one of those things where it's like he's always known for doing good work, that when he does something, even if it's like a little, it's like better than his normal like work or whatever, it's almost like you forget. They're like, oh yeah, this is probably kind of hard to do.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Yeah, it's like how we took DiCaprio for granted for like 12 years before we gave him an Oscar. Yeah.
He had to like freeze to death almost for them to be like, all
it
right.
Like, wasn't even like his best role. Like, we probably could have given it to him like years ago.
It kind of sucked a little bit. But like, he's like, listen, I'm in the wilderness. I fought a bear, man. Like, give me the goddamn statue. Even though like, I still maintain he should have won for Wolf of Wall Street, which came out like
absolutely.
I think a year or two earlier. And I was like, come on, that was the,
who did win that year?
Matthew McConaughey won for Dallas Buyers Club against DiCaprio and Wolf of Wall Street. So
right. I'm going to believe you. I'm not going to fact check you.
That's true, because that's been burned in my brain for a while.
Like, I've ever been since very the, upset the about Chris, it. The, ever since the Chris Devlin Texas Chainsaw episode.
Okay.
John won't even tell anyone his birthday anymore because he's not sure if that's right.
Actually, it's because I'm old. You hit 30 and then you're like, yeah, I don't want to talk about it anymore.
Anyway, John, what have you been watching?
So I watched a little movie called The Blob, the 1988 remake of the 1950s sci-fi film. It stars Johnny Drama.
Oh, and, yeah.
Real name, Kevin Dillon. But for those entourage aficionados out there, you get to see Johnny Drama with like the best mullet ever. And he's a, you know, he's an interesting guy. He's a loner. He's one of these guys that, like, you know, he talks back to the teacher or something, but the cops think he's like a bad guy, you know, like, oh, you know, you're 18 now. So if you do bad, you're going to jail, mister. And he's like, oh, quit hassling me, man. So there's a comet that hits this little small town and this little blob thing comes out of it and starts infecting everybody and getting bigger and bigger. And it's very silly, but like the kills are really like awesome and the effects are great. I would recommend it. It's the same director who did A Nightmare on Elm Street 3 and the Jim Carrey classic, The Mask.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Nice.
So The Blob. See it.
Awesome.
All right. Let's move on to our review of Freaky.
All right. The synopsis of Freaky. 17-year-old Millie Kessler is just trying to survive her senior year of high school. But when a cursed dagger causes her to switch bodies with the town's most notable serial killer, the Blissfield Butcher, high school drama becomes the least of her concerns. Millie now has 24 hours to find the killer and get her body back, or she risks staying the Blissfield Butcher forever. So, John, what'd you think of this one? This is the final slasher film of our series. What'd you think of it in terms of being a little exclamation point on this series?
I feel like it's a weirdly hopeful movie because it's kind of showing a new generation is kind of taking over as like the like protagonists of like these slasher films. So, you know, there's a lot of like throwbacks to like other slashers. It's very similar to Scream, but it has kind of its own unique identity, I think. And the way that the kids' characters, how they function in the movie, it feels like, you know, like Gen Z characters. They're different from, like, you know, they're not the same as, like, you know, like the characters in Scream, like these Gen X, like slacker types. Mm-hmm. It's kind of its own unique flavor. And I think that's pretty cool.
It felt to me like a revamped Scream. Like when you said that, it's like,
yeah,
that, like, it's, I don't think it's trying to be a parody as much as Scream was, but it's still like trying to not take itself too seriously while still clearly having respect for the slasher subgenre. And so I don't know. I thought of it as like, it's kind of like now that's what I call music of slasher films, where it's like, you know what I mean? That's like accessible. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we've seen a lot of it before, but we're still having a blast the whole time.
Oh yeah.
So I don't know. I thought it was a nice end to the series.
Yeah. And the thing I really liked about it, I think I was telling John before we were recording, was that it really paints kids very realistically, especially high school students. They're not too smart, they're not too dumb, they're just kind of like very average high school kids, and they're not overly sexualized, but they're not too goody-goody. Like, they're just really normal. Their world is the thing that's crazy, not them.
Yeah, it's they seem like relatively well-grounded for, you know, at least as opposed to how high school kids can sometimes be portrayed. I mean, I've been out of high school for quite a few years now, but I mean, you're a teacher, you see it all the time. So this is, you would say this is an accurate depiction of
today's high school kids. Especially with like the pandemic that's happened, my kids have said they're like never alone. Like, their parents know exactly where they are at any time. And I'm like, oh, you weren't neglectedly like raised on movies and TV?
Yeah, but then you also get like those helicopter parents that are like, a kid goes to college and then like the parent calls the dean of the college to be like, hey, my kid's having trouble with their roommate. And he's like, okay, what do you want me to do about it? Well, you're the dean. Fix it. The way that it approaches like youth culture and stuff, I think, is very strong. At least from our perspectives, maybe we're not quite. I mean, Lauren would know the best, but also she's an observer, more so that like you're not experiencing things as a Gen Z kid, you know.
Well, I mean, observing, it's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty big step into like, you know, being able to see how they operate, because like I think of this from time to time. It's like, I've been out of high school for so long, I don't really associate with a lot of people still in high school. You know, I might have some cousins here or there, but it's not like they're not,
I would hope, routinely not
telling me about high school. So it's like, but no, it's like, I realize like, I don't know what high school is like anymore. Like I just picture like, there's no chalkboards. It's just a giant iPad now. Like, I don't know what high school is. Like, I just picture it being really futuristic. Yeah. Like, they don't have textbooks or trapper keepers. Like, I don't know.
Jason, you grossly overestimate how much money they spend on education.
It's still the same chalkboards. There's just less, there's not enough chalk in the budget.
Yeah, it's yes. Same chalkboards, just no chalk.
If you're in like a really nice classroom, it's a whiteboard with Expo markers. Otherwise, it's still chalk and chalk.
Fresh Expo markers.
They accidentally order the permanent markers instead. And then they tell the teachers, just try to work around that.
Like, just, you're really going to have to teach the same thing for a while.
It's okay. They usually don't pick it up the first time anyway.
Okay. Another thing I would say is like, with us talking about like comparisons to Scream, I also think it's kind of interesting that like Neve Campbell's character, it's like, it's been a year since her mom died. And now in this one, it's like been a year since Millie's dad died. And then,
yeah,
like, you know, the movie kind of like concludes at like a big party, you know? Mm-hmm. So it kind of feels like Scream in a lot of ways, but like it is unique. But one thing, and I don't know if this is, I'm not sure if I'd call this a huge problem, but one thing I maybe enjoyed a little bit more about Scream was that it was a little bit more disaffected like and cynical than this one is. Mm-hmm. So like, you could watch any of like the quote unquote like emotional moments in Scream, and if it doesn't work for you, it's like whatever, like it doesn't matter. But like, this movie definitely goes for like pulling at the heartstrings a little bit, and I did think a few times it did feel like a little much. Mm-hmm. But it does kind of it maybe is more in keeping with the Gen Z kind of generation, where they are a little bit more in touch with emotions than say the Gen Xers, who are dead inside.
You got that a little bit with Sydney in Scream, though. I mean, and the whole like hinting at the how she put Cotton away, and you know, her dealing with that, like that got kind of serious. I don't know. I just didn't see it being any more or less.
But I mean, like that's like
serious in that regard.
That's like a character thing that like you watching it, you could watch that whole movie as a comedy and it works or something. You know, whereas this one, it definitely goes for like emotional moments with the family and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And they lay it on thick enough that it does feel like they want you to, you know, get a little weepy, little tear down the side of your face at some moments. I don't know.
I think it might just be an attempt to add a little bit of dimension to our protagonist, our Millie character, you know, kind of like a reimagined final girl, I guess, you know. So, cause I think like, you know, you gotta be rooting for these people. And I think it kind of helps in that regard, you know, making them a little sympathetic. Cause like the humor is definitely, it's, I would consider it much more of a comedy, like a straight up comedy than Scream. So I think it kind of has to earn that a little bit. Like the people going in expecting something a little bit more serious or traditional slasher, you know, you kind of have that as the groundwork.
That's true. I would also say one thing that's, I would say maybe to talk a little bit about how it is different from Scream. I think the like body swap element adds some nice like changes to the formula. I mean, it's doing body swap formula a little bit, but it's kind of mixing and matching things. So you have more fun with it.
I mean, you can't really like, if you do a body swap movie, you can't veer away from the formula that much. Mm-hmm. Like it kind of is what it is. If you swap bodies with somebody, you have to have like the realization scenes. Like there's no way around it.
So, and it has to be kooky too. Like you can't just continue on with your life as normal. Like, oh, I guess this is how I live now. Like, that's not how it happens.
Sweet.
But so with body swap movies, I feel like there are two things that happen that usually can kind of like slow the movie down to an extent that might not be great. And I think this movie avoids those. So the first one is incorporating this like sci-fi element of like, how did they get body swapped? And I think this one works really well because it's like, we know you don't really give a shit, so we're gonna like throw something in there, and it's like, oh, it's a weapon, blah, 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 whatever. And
then they don't try to overexplain it.
Yeah. And then they move on. And then the other one is, okay, how does the character now explain it to others? With this one, it's like they turn it into an action scene. So like, it's funny, ridiculous, and fun. And then like, the part of the appeal of it is like, with them not getting it right away, you get kind of a fight scene. So it works. I think it works really well in that aspect. It is following the tropes. It knows, like, you've been down this road before. We're not going to stick to these things for too long. You get it. Mm-hmm. You're not stupid. You know, so they can just, all right, we're going to do this, then we're moving on. And I think that's a really smart move.
Yeah. And it also has an interesting element, like where Millie becomes the butcher, and at no point is she trying to like convince anyone that she's the butcher or trying to play along. Yeah. There's, you know what I mean? It's like the butcher's already like a wanted man. So it's like, she naturally has become wanted. And I feel like that's an interesting dynamic to the body swap thing. Cause there's normally like, it's at some point it's both of these characters then like coming to some sort of agreement, like, okay, like you be me, this is what I would do. Mm-hmm. You like, I'll be what I would do. So,
or like the hot chick mode, which was you don't have the Rob Schneider in like the girl's body. Like, she's not in it as much. Whereas that freaky, they keep it like you get both aspects constantly.
Yeah.
And also like they use it as like this like nice little like aspect of like a wish fulfillment for like all the people that have wronged Millie in her, you know, real life. The butcher's in her body, and then he is like exacting revenge on all these people.
Well, and it also brings up this point that like all these kids make fun of Millie and think she's ugly and all of this stuff, and all she needed to do was put on lipstick and put her hair in a ponytail and wear a leather jacket, and now she's hot. Like, and the thing that's like, I think, so frustrating about it is when the serial killer is in Millie's body, he doesn't talk. So it has nothing to do with her personality, why they don't like her. Like, it's literally her existence is just annoying to them. And now that she's hot, it's okay.
Yeah. Like,
do you think that's like a critique on those movies? Like, that's all it takes is a ponytail and some lipstick. Cause it's like, I don't know. That's like, you know, a kind of a cliche in itself. Like, it's just like you have the girl who's clearly pretty, but you just messed up her hair a little and made her wear something kind of silly. Like, I don't know. What's that movie? Like The Princess Diaries or something, where it's like, you know, she's like,
oh, like you have frizzy hair and glasses. Oh, you're an uggo.
Right.
Yeah. It's like,
but I think, I think part of it too is like a characterization thing that like, if Millie was just slightly more confident, people would notice her in a more positive light.
Or they wouldn't mess with her.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is a good time to mention like Vince Vaughn and Catherine Newton. Mm-hmm. I think they both do a great job with this movie. Like,
oh yeah.
I think now my slight critique, I'll say this before I kiss ass, but I don't know if I think they're like phenomenal at being the people that are not, like when they're not switched, but like after they've switched bodies, I think they're like really great. Like, they really embody those characters very well. Mm-hmm. And especially Vince Vaughn as like a teen girl. I couldn't get enough of it. I think that was so much fun.
I wanted to be his friend.
He had the mannerisms down.
Well, it's also like, it's not really that far off from like a normal Vince Vaughn like comedy performance. It's just slightly heightened a bit, and it kind of, you know, like when you have like Vince Vaughn's one of those guys that like naturally could be just like a car salesman. Mm-hmm. like that's just his little brand. So like when you have like, okay, he's now like a teenage girl, it's like you just heighten certain kind of things, and then it's like, oh, okay, that seems like he's being a younger lady.
Well, and I like the comedy doesn't come out of him being like effeminate. Like, it's not like he's wearing like bras and tank tops, and it's like, isn't this so silly that Vince Vaughn is this way? It's, he actually acts like a real person who is like in this kind of unprecedented situation and having to be a wanted person, but is trying to do the right thing. And then like also trying to interact with family members and friends and like explain like who they are. So I think a lot of the comedy just comes out of naturally the interactions without it being like, isn't this funny that I'm this grown man acting like a teenage girl all the time. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's also things like where it's like she's not used to his strength. Mm-hmm. So like when she's like, hey, like trying to get someone's attention, she'll accidentally hurt them a little bit too much. Like, oh, I'm
so strong.
Yeah. Or like hitting the branches on trees because she's not used to the height that she is now.
When you guys think of Vince Vaughn, what's your favorite Vince Vaughn performance? What comes to mind? First thing you think about?
Probably Old School.
Old School?
I mean, the first thing that comes to mind, is it Dodgeball? But I don't know if that's my favorite. That's just
Dodgeball.
The first
Dodgeball
thing that comes to mind.
What about you, okay. Jason?
I go Wedding Crashers. I think he kills it in Wedding Crashers. I think he's so good.
I've only seen it
that's
once.
Just like what I just think of Vince Vaughn as that person all the time.
Just to give you an idea of how much high school has changed, I saw Wedding Crashers, the unrated version, on a high school field trip for my senior year. That would not fly by today's standards.
Yeah. I don't know if that would have...
Wait, you saw... Like, the school showed it?
They... Because we were on, like, a big bus. It wasn't, like, a school bus, but, you know, like, one of those, I don't know, sort of, like, rented out Greyhound buses. And they put it on the TV screens that are on the bus. And they're like, okay, we're going to pop this version in. And the unrated version. Pretty sure that the bus driver...
That'd be like lawsuits nowadays, right?
Right? I'm pretty sure the bus driver had just, like, movies... in the glove compartment. I was like, here you go, chaperones. Which one do we want to watch? They're like, this is fine. They're not going to pay attention to it. And I was like, Why are they showing this?
I remember at some point in my high school time, they were going to show the original Psycho, but then parents complained because it was rated R, so they couldn't show it. And I was like, it's from 1960.
Yeah.
Like, that's going
to... Is that actually rated R?
I'm not even sure it's actually rated R, but like maybe it was re-rated
R
later.
They like got away with like anything back then.
Oh,
it was
for
like
sure.
G or PG.
Well, yeah. So like, I guess they couldn't show the movie or something. It was something like absurd. I was like, what parent is like complaining about Psycho?
Yeah. Mind you, this is also the high school where as a freshman, we were reading V for Vendetta in English class. And my teacher got in trouble for showing us the R-rated movie as 14-year-olds. And I'm like, how? How can that happen my freshman year? But by senior year, they're like, Wedding Crashers. Here you go.
Yeah, whatever. Wow. It's just funny that there is this weird flux of like what was acceptable and what wasn't. And it's like, things became more acceptable and then they went the other way.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's get into the plot of the movie. So first we're treated to an opening scene with four teens that are hanging out and they're talking about this Blissfield Butcher character. And wouldn't you know it, Blissfield Butcher, he shows up and kills everyone. And it's like pretty graphic and hilarious in like equal measures. And I like that the movie does that because it's kind of like telling everyone like, all right, you're going to see some stuff, but we're going to have some fun.
That's a great way to describe it. It sets the stage really well. Because honestly, I started this movie. I didn't know anything about it. I don't know anything about any of the movies we talk about on here, but that's neither here nor there. But I knew the premise and I didn't know if it was like more of a comedy or how over the top it would be, or if it was going to try to play it serious. And like, it sets the stage. It's like, okay, this is what we're getting into. I get it. I'm on board. Let's do it.
Yeah. For me personally, my favorite kills are the wine bottle down the throat and then breaking the bottle.
Yeah.
It's like... Because you think it's like, what's he putting in his mouth? And it's like, it's a wine bottle. And you're like, well, where's this going? And then breaks it. And then like all the shards come out of his like throat or whatever.
Yeah.
And like, so that one was hysterical. And then the other one that I really laughed at was when he breaks a tennis racket in half and then sticks it in the guy's head.
And there's this really cool shot right after that where you just see the tennis racket and then you see like the blood dripping down it, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that it's a very, I don't want to say flashy movie, but like the direction of it is very assured, I think.
Yeah.
They have some great shots in it. One little point of reference, interestingly, the budget for this movie was only $6 million. And I think this movie looks quite a bit more expensive than that.
Right. Yeah. I would have thought that would have gotten you Vince Vaughn. And then there goes your $6 million.
Maybe in 2005, but maybe not now. Oh, another thing that I thought was great, the cut from when the one girl is getting her head smashed in by the toilet to then the girl who's having sex and like her head's hitting the car. I don't know. It's just such a good setup, though, because then you're like, OK, we know this is very silly and it's
chaos for like instantly. And then the parents get home and their daughter's pinned to the wall and
like she's a painting.
And we established that the parents are art collectors, and there's this possibly cursed knife, this really expensive thing that he just got. Yeah. It's like still in the box, and the Blissfield Butcher takes the knife. It's just so much happens, and it's like we're hitting the ground running, and then like, okay, you know.
Let me ask you this, okay? Someone's in your house, all right, and they've killed people in front of you, and then you find the secret compartment to get into like the secret hiding, your panic room or whatever.
Okay, you don't leave. That was so stupid. I was like,
yeah.
So when I've seen it twice, but when I was watching it again to prepare for recording today, I was like, well, that was stupid to go in the closet. Like, he's gonna find you right away, and you have no escape. And then I didn't remember that there was the hidden compartment. So then when I see her coming out of the hidden compartment, I'm like, no, you stay there. You stay there and you hope he gets bored and leaves the house. Because he can't find you. Like
they had that made for that exact moment, and she blew it. Like, I mean, there had to have been there had to have at least been like a couple bottles of water in there, maybe a magazine. We don't know what was in there. Maybe she would have ran out of oxygen in like 5 minutes, and it was a terrible little escape room. But
you're being very kind to her.
Well, especially because once she gets out of the closet, there's like these big French doors or like these big windows in that room that she could have left out of, but instead heard her parents coming home and was like, let me go run to greet mom and dad.
And then you hear them going, I wonder what that car at the end of the driveway is about.
Yeah.
All right. What would you guys put in a panic room? You have we'll say it was, could you lay down? Do you think it was big enough to lay down?
Yeah.
All right. We'll say it's 10 by 10.
I assumed it was a huge room for that.
By the way it was lit, maybe, like behind her, I feel like it had to have been like,
all right, bigger. So you have a 10 by 10 panic room. What, you have three essentials. What's in there for this moment?
Water.
Well, like, we're stuck in there for how long?
You don't know. That's a panic room. It's not like,
okay.
Toilet paper.
Okay, toilet paper. Sure.
I'm going with wet wipes then.
Okay.
Toilet paper
instead of wet wipes. You're not doing water, toilet paper, and wet wipes. Those are not your three items, right?
No, I'm going with water, wet wipes, and I don't know, some peanut butter maybe. That's
of course.
I'm a big fan of peanut butter. So.
I think maybe like pretzels. I don't know, something bland that I won't get tired of.
So when
of.
You get like all dehydrated from the salt, you drink the water.
Yeah, it'd be fine.
Would have thought maybe a weapon. Would have thought one of you would have picked a weapon.
I thought you were, you're already in there. You don't need anything else.
Jason, I think I established that I was going to hunker down in there for as long as
possible.
You're going
to stay in there. But what if they start getting in there? Then you're screwed. If you have no, John's going to throw a jar of peanut butter at him.
Look,
that's good. What if they're allergic, though? That might do the trick.
Once I went in there, I knew that like there's a 50-50 shot of me getting out alive from this situation. Yeah, so
okay.
I've come to peace with I might die over this.
Lauren is one of the few people that really handled the COVID stuff well. She's like, all right, hunker down and stay in place. It's like, okay. So if she was in that situation, she's in there like a couple of days. Like the cops are outside going like, ma'am, we can like, we'll slide our badges under the, no, it's fine. I'm staying in here.
I'm taking a nap.
Lauren's in there writing like lesson plans and stuff. She's like, I'm actually being very productive.
She's giving me notes on like how my editing is for the episodes. John, I think you can cut that lame joke you made that no one laughed at. You don't need to put in fake laughs, just get rid of it.
Why was I in here? Oh, right. The butcher.
So at the end of all that, as Jason mentioned, he steals a dagger called La Dola. And next we meet Millie, her sister Char, and her lush of a mother, Coral.
What is it with all of these slasher movies that there's so many women who are just alcoholics? Like, I saw that and I wrote down, I was like, this is like the mom in Nightmare on Elm Street, or is this like the house mother in Black Christmas? Or
yeah.
It's just very funny how like she's the least functioning of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the morning she seems okay, but then by like afternoon, like she's done.
Yeah.
So then you know, they're all dealing with the death of the father. We mentioned that Millie, instead of going to the homecoming dance, is gonna go to a local play of Wicked. And even her cop sister, who is probably one the squarest person in the movie, thinks that's lame.
Like at the Anus Theater.
See, that's like such a good thing, because it's like normal kids aren't like super super clever, but that's like anus, like kids would just have that, and then that's like make that joke, and like that becomes like the kind of the go-to name for that place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just feels very real, I think. Next we see Millie. She's getting picked up by her friends Nyla and Josh, and we learn about her secret crush Booker. You know, another great name, Booker Strode. Like, I mean, I dig the reference, but like,
I don't know, man. I think anything goes for first names now.
Mm-hmm.
With kids.
Yeah, and even in this movie too, like there's some weird names.
Here's Ryler.
Ryler.
Well, actually, so Ryler shows up and then proceeds to bully Millie for her like thrifty clothing, I guess.
There's a lot of like just like instantly mean kids in the scene. Mm-hmm. And Lauren, I wanted to ask, like, do kids like that exist? Like, do like the second someone walks into school, are bullies surrounding them and doing their thing? I don't know. I went to school with some assholes, but like they at least try to hide it, and they at least try to like pick their moments. And it's like right when the door's open, someone's barking at her. Like all this stuff's happening. Like, are kids like that?
I mean, I've worked in two different high schools, and no, I think kids are more socially aware that like if you're going to be mean to a kid, you can't be like obnoxiously obvious about it.
Right.
Yeah.
But also like, I think this was more so when I was in high school than you guys, but there was a lot about cyberbullying and like legislation that like if you bully a kid and they commit suicide, like you can be responsible for murder because you led to their suicide. Right. So I think there's a lot of things that have kind of come out of the woodwork that's made it so that kids typically, it's just not even worth their time to bully each other. The comment about her clothing being from like a cheap thrift store or whatever, is kids wouldn't even comment about that. Like, I don't think they would care enough to be like, oh, your clothes are from Walmart or something.
It's like cool to get your clothes like wherever now. It's like, what, you know, it's a thrift stores are cool now. It's like,
yeah. I don't know. Well, I remember when I was younger, it was like certain people anyway, it would be more like, you're not wearing like American Eagle or like Abercrombie or something. Like there was a little bit of that, but in a great way that like went away.
Well, and I think that's maybe that's more of a middle school thing to like make fun of each other by what you're wearing, because I think by the time you're in high school, it's like life has, I don't know, put you down enough that you're like, this is not worth starting a fight over.
I feel
over.
Like high school kids nowadays are a little more self-aware than they used to be.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I feel like, you know, being that overt of a bully is kind of so cliche at this point. It's like, what? Really? Like, that's how we're going to treat somebody?
Well, speaking of like, you know, bullying and whatnot, we go to the next scene where Millie is somehow late to woodshop class, and we get Mr. Bernardi giving her shit in like the weirdest way. Like, hey, I know you were supposed to like present your project in 5 days, but I'm going to make you present right now because you were late to class. After just kissing the ass of that like jock guy, his like doghouse, it's like, oh, this is phenomenal.
Like, I love the teacher character. He loves that doghouse, and the jock is like so into it. That scene really cracked me up. That guy was great. What's the guy's name? The guy from Ferris Bueller. He was so funny.
But I just love how like, oh, there you go, wasting everyone's time again.
I will say,
just
though,
so over the top.
Like, no teacher could get away with talking to a kid that way. Like, ever. No matter how much you want to say those things, you can't.
So I think one of the things that I think the movie touches upon with this character that's cool is that certain teachers, like, they have favorites mm-hmm. with their, like, students. But most teachers can kind of keep that quiet enough. But, like, the ones that are terrible at hiding it are the shop teachers and gym teachers. Mm-hmm. Like, they're basically the kids that graduated high school, didn't really like living in the real world, so then they have to go back to high school.
Well, yeah, and they get off on being looked up to by themselves when, like, 10 years ago. Like, that's the whole,
yeah.
That's the whole appeal to that, and it's kind of sad when you think about it.
Not kind of, it, well, it's very sad.
It's sad, of, you know, of sorts, I guess.
You have gym teachers that would be like, oh, if you're not good at, like, fast enough at running the mile, they, like, hate you.
Well, do you, like, in our high school, I don't know if you had him. I never did, thank God. But there was one gym teacher who, if you weren't good at whatever it was that you were playing and you were lucking out and, like, doing well, he would start playing to get you out on, like, kickball, or he'd join the other team's volleyball team and then, like, spike the ball at you and, like, do these things. And I remember getting so mad and almost, and I didn't, but almost saying, like, wow, you really have to show how awesome you are by beating 15-year-olds in gym class. You should be a pro.
Yeah.
What was his angle to, like, breed the greatest, like, dodgeball team the school had ever seen or something? Like,
well, it's like they had a few periods of gym class and, like, they're itching to get back out there. Like,
right.
Oh, I gotta show them how it's done.
But when it came to, like, days when we'd have to run around the track, magically they'd be nowhere to be found. They'd be on the bleachers sitting and talking. It's like, oh, you don't want to show me how fast you can run? But you can show me how hard you can throw a dodgeball. Cool.
So we're at the homecoming game and Millie is the mascot for some reason. This guy Phil, who apparently makes great dog houses, also likes to throw soda cans at her for no reason. And, like, they, like, yell stuff at her, but it's like they're so close to her that it's like no one else would hear them. It's just like being cruel for no reason.
I also just find it weird that she's the mascot, considering, like, and
she doesn't know anything about sports.
Right. Yeah. And in my experience, usually whoever is the mascot is somebody who's also kind of athletic to some degree. Like, maybe football is not their sport, but they're a soccer player or they're something else, or they're close with the cheerleaders. Usually it's not the most unpopular kid in the high school who isn't very, like, I don't know, physically talented.
I get that. I think I was okay with it just because it was very on brand for the whole film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I don't know, I just like that detail, and it's very memorable, and that the whole scene that follows that with her being chased is even more memorable because she's got the mascot suit on still. And I guess it kind of makes sense. Isn't there some line where it's like extracurriculars look good on college applications or something? And it makes sense because she's like, she probably wants to be the center of attention as little as possible, but at least now she can put on, like, a mask and just, like, do her thing and then go home.
That's true.
So, like, if she has to be there, if she has to be in this very, like, jockish setting with all these kids, like, she might as well, like, put on a mask. So
yeah, like, she's, I don't know. It's her way of being invisible, I guess, but also, like, doing something that can help her for college
right
stuff.
Which is,
I mean, she also probably could have done something that was, like, not football related too, but, you know,
not be around the people that hate her.
and it also establishes, like, it sets up the next scene where she meets the serial killer and her having to run away from him, which I was like, if only you weren't in that mascot costume, you might actually be able to get away. But because you're in that, it is so awkward to run in.
I love that like one of the things that, like, really fucks her up is that her lush of a mother got too drunk and forgot to pick her up.
Yeah, you kind of get the sense that this has happened before. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, what? She was pretty confident that her mom was going to come. And it is like pretty sad and, you know, kind of tragic, like why she is drinking so much. Like she really misses her husband. And it's like you kind of can justify it to an extent. But if it's at the point where you're leaving your daughter sit there in a mascot costume and she's being pursued by the Blissfield Butcher, you should probably rethink your drinking habits.
Mm. Well, it's interesting how they have the mom seems to consistently overcompensate for her fuck ups. So it's like, okay, so she wasn't there at night, but then like the next morning, you know, or whatever, she's always making really nice breakfast.
Really big breakfast. Yeah.
Yeah. Things like that.
Yeah. And like, she's not like an inherently unlikable character. You kind of sense that she means well and she like really kind of wants what's best for Dar.
The butcher, you know, chases Millie down and then stabs her in the shoulder with the Lodola. Mm-hmm. And then he gets a similar wound on the same left shoulder. And so if you're about to stab somebody, then all of a sudden the ground you're on turns into like an Aztec like pyramid, like building or pyramid or whatever. Wouldn't you go, I'm going to put that guy down. I don't know what's happening here.
Well, the butcher, he's in the zone and he is pumped to have a new knife. Like he's really excited about that thing. And I mean, I don't know. Maybe he just got caught up in the moment.
I mean, it has eyes on it that light up, Jason. Yeah. Like who wouldn't be excited?
Yeah, seriously.
He's kind of like an animal of sorts, the way he acts. So it's kind of like that. His baser instincts are what drive him more than anything else. So,
I mean, think about the night he just had, you know, right before that or a couple of days ago. He got to kill like four teenagers. He had a good time doing that, and he got a new toy. Like that was a banner night for him. He is itching to use that thing.
Anyway, so Char, she shows up. She sees, you know, the butcher with the knife standing over her sister and just shoots in the air. She does not seem like a great cop, I'll say that.
Yeah, her gun skills are concerning. We're going to come back to that later in the movie.
We'll get to that. Yeah. But it's weird when she decides to shoot at people and not. The next morning, the butcher wakes up and he's in Millie's body. And the mom tries to, like, you know, come in and, like, make up for her drunken habits. And has like a really nice breakfast planned. Then like the butcher almost kills Char and maybe the mother too. But then the mother just takes the knife away. And like there's a lot of like moments where if you see someone holding a butcher knife looking menacing like that, you would think like the family would be a little bit more concerned. Be like,
for sure. Like it happens multiple times in the movie too, where I'm like, why are you not concerned she's holding a knife?
Well, this particular instance is we go back to the mom trying to overcompensate. She's like, oh, I'll take care of that, honey. Grabs the knife and starts just slicing something. Like she's thinking she's trying to like what cut her pineapple or whatever. But
yeah.
You see, in our house, that wouldn't be the case. Like if either of us was holding a knife, my mother would be like, oh, you're trying to kill me? Is that what's going on? Because I know you're not trying to cut food.
Make yourself useful with that thing.
My mom could ask me to do something for her. I'm doing it. And then she goes, what are you doing with that knife?
Yes.
I was like, don't worry.
And then she'd yell at you. Obvious. You'd be at the counter cutting something. And then she'd yell at you for sneaking up on her and scaring her. Yeah. Like, that's the type of person she is.
Yeah, so the next thing we see Millie waking up in the butcher's body, and he's got quite the little lair. A lot of dead animals hanging up for no reason. Homeless people ask to buy drugs from him. So, you know, you find out the butcher's got a little bit of a side hustle going on. So I think that's interesting. We cut back to the butcher in Millie's body. Apparently, the butcher's really quite good at women's fashion, because everyone sees Millie with like the leather jacket and everyone's like, holy shit, she looks good.
It would have been kind of funny if she just came in looking like really absurd and the makeup is just awful and like overdone. Like at this point, we don't even know if this guy can speak. Like he hasn't even said a word.
Yeah, exactly. So she walks in, and then like as soon as she walks in, like this, like there's like this whole convoluted scene, but basically we get Millie and Ryler go to like the women's locker room, and Ryler wants to find out what happened because she's seen a lot of episodes of SVU, so something more must have happened to her. The butcher doesn't really tell her much, so then Ryler's like, whatever, I'm going to the bathroom. When I come back, you better start telling me something or I'm getting out of here. So she goes to the bathroom and walks in on like Vince Vaughn showering. Or Millie as the butcher showering, and she screams. And then the butcher like tells her like, oh, I'll hide you in this like cryogenic chamber. Or cryotherapy tank or whatever that is. Very strange thing to have in a school.
I think this might be the most far-fetched thing in the movie. Like, even more far-fetched than this, like, mystical dagger. One, a cryogenic freezer thing accessible in a locker room that students can use. Like, number one, wouldn't be in the school. Number two, if it was in the school, it would be like in some office locked up where only one person knows how to use it. And that person retired 3 years ago and they never hired somebody else and they don't know how to work it. Like, that's how schools operate. Like,
what does it even do in practice? Is it like a physical therapy thing?
Yeah, like I mean, my assumption is, like, I know a lot of times athletes, after they do like intense practices and workouts, especially if they've had injuries, they'll go to the physical therapist and they'll put them in like an ice bath. So essentially that's what that does, except it's, you just kind of walk in there and you get like cold air and you can come out. I think it's supposed to be more effective and probably you have more control over the temperature.
Yeah.
But like no public high school would have that.
Right.
Especially one that's just right there. Just
I'd be interested to see like where the writers went to high school. That's probably just like a normal thing. And they're like, wherever, Malibu High.
Yeah. Children can be such animals that they would never trust that to be in a locker room. Like, today was the last day of school for my students and kids were like vandalizing bathrooms. And I'm like, there's no way they would leave this in a locker room.
Yeah, I guess maybe if it was in like, if the high school was big enough and sports focused enough that they had like a sports physician on staff and maybe they broke into that office and it was like some sort of specialized thing. But yeah, I was like,
I mean,
I was very like amused by the scene, but I was also like, what is this? We're in a high school locker room. Like, we didn't even have like the soap stocked up at all times in our high school locker room, and they have a cryogenic freezer.
Our locker room didn't even have locks on the lockers. They were like, you have to supply your own. So
but I did like that when Millie finds Ryler's body, she like taps the shoulder. It rocks back and then falls down and breaks into a million like little pieces.
Yeah.
And she just walks away.
Frozen. It was frozen through that quickly.
And it's just like, well, I can't stay here and think about this anymore. I'm going to just go on living my life.
Well, and as you said, like, the deaths in this movie, especially now that we're not in the opening scene, they're all people who have wronged Millie in some way. And I started to notice a pattern that all the deaths, I think maybe I'm reading too much into it, are symbolic in some way. So like, here you have Ryler, who's been always like cruel and cold and mean to her. And she dies in like this very cruel and cold manner. And we'll see some of those other ones later as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, in a lot of the films we've seen before, you know, the people being pursued and being killed are more or less innocent to some regard. They may have some shortcomings, you know, one form or another, but it's like, it's almost like we're expecting this, if not even rooting for it, because we know it's going to be like over the top. We know it's going to be ridiculous. And we know these characters have it coming. And it's not like, oh no, not whatever, you know, not whoever. It's like, it's all these
not
people.
Ryler.
That no one's saying that. It's like,
Even Ryler's friends probably didn't think about it much, like a day or two later, like, oh yeah, she's dead now, right?
No, they're the group that's like, okay, now who's like the boss of this little lady clique we have? Like, you know.
Well, Millie killed her, so I guess she's the cool girl now, I guess. I don't know. She has a leather jacket. That's all you need.
And a ponytail.
So, all right. So, the butcher goes to shop class and... I really like this scene. Booker is doing something and he cuts his finger. So he grabs his finger and sucks on the blood. Mr. Bernardi is like, I'm so sick of your constant need for attention. It's like he erupts and then just kind of keeps going on with the class. He's such a dick. I love that. I don't know.
And there's nothing to suggest that she has constantly needed attention in any form like before this. It's just like something he's fabricated in his mind to justify treating her this way.
Yeah, it's like Millie's late a little bit, so therefore
she wants
what attention. An asshole that kid. yeah, that kid wants attention. So Millie finds Nyla and Josh, and we're treated to this big fight scene where they keep trying to beat the shit out of Millie.
But it's so ineffective. Like, everything is so bad.
It doesn't do anything to, like, the butcher's body. And it's only after Millie, like, overpowers both of them by sheer strength that they're on the ground like, oh, wow, that hurt, you know? And she, like, I don't know if I think this would have convinced me, but just, like, she starts doing like the like dance that she does as the mascot, and they're all like, whoa, wait, what's your favorite movie? Who's your crush? You know, like,
and then I don't the think secret those handshake. They got the secret handshake.
I would have liked the secret handshake a little more than just like Pitch Perfect 2 is my favorite movie. And I really like this guy, Booker, you know, like that, those are all things that anyone, if they were like just watching someone for like a week, they would probably figure out.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But yeah, so she explains everything. Then finally they're like, oh, you're the real Millie. So see, here's the thing that I feel like is weird with like some of these body swap movies. Like if you try to be too realistic, then people aren't going to buy into like the body swap thing for a very long time. But also, like, when you're watching a movie and that, like, you don't want like a half hour of them not believing her. Like, that'd be so fucking boring. So you're like, they kind of just have to be like, wow, you're the real Millie. And then we're like, all right, we're moving on. No more shock about this.
It's so well executed because you know that scene's coming and you know they're going to get there in some form of like some sort of communication of a fact, or, you know, in this case, like a dance and a handshake that only they would know. Like, you know, it's going to come to that. But then you have this really interesting chase through the kitchen where they're like trying to foil who they think is the butcher, but failing and throwing like tater tots at him and like, you know, plates and stuff, and nothing is working. So it's like they're basically at the point where they're like cornered and overpowered by this person. And then, you know, that it starts to add up. They're like, okay, well, this is better than, I guess, being stabbed to death, you know?
Cool. Right. And I love how it makes fun of itself too. I think it's Josh is like, I'm gay and you're black. Like, this is bad for us. And just like pointing out the so many of the tropes of horror movies that are about to like occur.
Yeah. I also thought maybe it was like another indicative thing about like it being like kind of a Gen Z movie is that a movie, let's say 10 years ago, if you have like, you know, Nyla and Josh, like their like identities would be much more like, oh, Nyla is going to have to deal with some sort of racism. And then Josh is going to have to deal with more like more overt, like homophobia or something. They can just be them without it being about like something.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be a thing. It's not like defining their character. Mm-hmm. It's just like part of who they are.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think that's a smart move, because then, I don't know, like you don't have to slow the movie down to be like, all right, real world talk, bigotry is bad. You know, you like get it, you know. Like
we paused this body swap movie for some social commentary.
I got to say, I don't know, maybe this is me being childish, but like, I really enjoyed the whole part where like Vince Vaughn's peeing and he's like flopping. He's like, this is ridiculous. And another thing that I thought the movie, like a low key, really funny aspect of the movie, is all the crazy shit they have written on the stalls. I was like pausing them and reading them, and I was just like, oh, they would never let that stay up for longer than like a day, like at my high school. Like, they would get rid of that. But I enjoyed all the like artistic renderings of like a butthole and stuff.
No, and you make a good point about the peeing scene. It's like they don't, there's just the right amount of the like this is a new anatomy I have, like I think there's just the right amount of that to be like funny, and then we move on. It's not like constantly,
they understand the intelligence of the audience to be like, all right, we're going to go there, but we're not going to stay there for too long.
And it makes sense. Like, if you're peeing for the first time standing up, like, that's cool. Like, you're like, this is kind of nice. Sorry, Lauren.
For those that don't know, Jason actually peed sitting down for the first 20 years of his life.
I don't even know where to go with that.
Because, Jason, if you deny it, then it seems like something suspicious, but you also don't want to confirm that either.
I can neither confirm nor deny this statement.
Though I'm wondering how John knows that to be true. That's the interesting question. Part. Are you a little peeping Tom? Have you been bring it full back?
I know, like, that's a type of a joke that I would make that Jason wouldn't even like give any room with. He'd just be like, all right, we're moving on. But anyway, all right. So in this scene, they're like talking about the Lodola dagger, and then they find out basically that they have 24 hours to get Millie to stab the butcher, and then they can swap back or the whole thing's permanent. We mentioned that earlier.
But there's also that nice little moment where they pull up the article about it, and the writing on the daggers in Spanish, and like what's his name is in Spanish class, Josh. Josh is in Spanish class, but doesn't know enough Spanish to like interpret it. And like
he's in Spanish three.
Yeah. The teacher,
but he has dyslexia, guys.
He's dyslexic. Yeah. So that's
the teacher gives him a hard time, but that's just like a funny little way of that being like revealed. And the Spanish teacher's like your kind of cliche, over the top Spanish teacher that, you know, do you guys take Spanish in high school where they'd like, mm-hmm. they'd like see you at lunch and they would like give you a little phrase to test you? I'm like, whoa, lady, I'm off the clock. It is lunchtime.
I took German, actually.
I took 2 years of German and 2 years of Spanish, and I learned more in those 2 years of Spanish than I did in those 2 years of German.
That's why I like German so much.
German was fun. It wasn't necessarily educational.
So my German teacher, he used to play favorites with like the sports guys. Yeah. And I wasn't really picked on by anybody, but like I wasn't like close with them. Mm-hmm. So sometimes when my teacher, he would like kind of pick on me for not knowing something, they would kind of like laugh a little too hard at it and I would get embarrassed. So the teacher asked me some point, he's like, he asked me a question in German, and I didn't know what he was asking. And I was like, and then he's like, you don't know? You don't know? And he was like giving me shit about it. So I said, I think it's obvious I wasn't listening or something like that or whatever. And then he goes, oh, it's obvious. Oh, it's obvious. Huh, it's obvious. And then he took the German book and threw it at the wall. Oh, it's obvious. John thinks it's obvious.
Jeez.
And then he like left.
I can attest. Also had that German teacher. You did not like pave a good path for me to have him either. Like he's like, oh, John's reputation
ruined high school for
but
you.
So the next day in school, he wasn't there. So I thought I broke his brain. So the day after when he showed up, I think like I wrote him a note or something apologizing to him because I felt bad. Because I didn't want him to have some sort of breakdown.
He didn't deserve that note.
Oh, poor Lauren. I didn't even think about having all the same teachers as John.
Well,
and
like,
what
here's
precedent
the thing.
He must have set for the Hoyer name.
Well, it's the law of diminished expectations.
Yes, because I was going to say, like, they'd be like, oh, are you John's sister? And I'm like, I don't know, am I?
Who wants to know?
And they'd be like, he's so nice. I'm like, yes, I am his sister. Nice to have you this year. He only said great things about you. But then when it came to German class, I was like, all right, well.
Yeah.
John, was he your Mr. Bernard?
Yes.
Yeah, no, actually, I really liked his class a lot and enjoyed him because he was very funny. But just sometimes he would like, he would do this thing of trying to embarrass you to make you like want to work harder or something. Mm-hmm. But it like, it would have the opposite effect where like, I would just want to be like, I would just like want to shut down and not like, whatever, I'll get a C in this class. I don't care, you know, sort of thing. So,
yeah, you also yeah, couldn't but, like, you couldn't, have quips that were smarter than his quips either. Like that I found out real fast. In his class.
Yeah, you wouldn't like that.
No, I couldn't I couldn't be mean to him like I'm mean to Jason and like make people proud of me.
All right. So Millie, she's in the bathroom and I guess one of her bullies comes in and gives the Millie's character a hard time in the stall. So Millie uses her tall stature and brute strength to make him piss himself and promise not to bully anyone again.
So this is, we enter the fun and games portion of the movie, which if you've ever, there's a good screenwriting book called Save the Cat. It just talks about like a time-tested formula for screenplays. And this screenplay really follows that. This is kind of where we get, you know, these two characters exploring what they can do with these newfound bodies of theirs. And it gets pretty silly.
So then we have the butcher goes into Mr. Bernardi's room. And I love, this is like a thing that you see in like more so like TV shows like The Simpsons or something, where a character walks in or starts talking to another character and they need that person to be doing some sort of thing already. Like they're walking into someone doing something. Mm-hmm. And I love it when they come up with like a character doing something a little weird or having a little funny thing that they just walk into. And for Mr. Bernardi, it's like, he's like reading someone's name. He goes, that's a stupid name.
Yeah, that is really a Simpsons thing.
Hot Rod had that a lot where like, you know, like Andy Samberg's character would walk in on his friends doing like weird things where they're smacking each other. So then Millie attacks him and tries to kill him. And Mr. Bernardi gets too much of a thrill out of beating the shit out of Millie's body.
Yeah, he wastes no time.
He's like, this is self-defense.
You know? But then kicks her while, or like kicks the butcher rather, while he's down and just like a couple times in the gut. She's so starved for attention.
No, it's a good scene. And then the butcher is able to stab him just like in the neck, blood spraying out, and he's like, uh-oh. And then the butcher splits him in half, which, I mean, man, this school's got some good equipment. Like
some you know? Sharp saws, for sure.
Yeah.
That's a very good table saw. Just slices him right down the middle.
No wonder that doghouse looks so immaculate.
I will say I'm glad that they committed to these deaths, because a lot of like the easy thing to do is just like start pushing him through and then you just see like blood splatter on some like her face or something. But they're just like, nope, we're gonna show him like going in half.
Symbolically also works really well too, because he always is like cutting her down. Right. Like everything he says is always like either to like tear her apart, cut her down in some way. And literally that's exactly how the butcher kills him, which I was like, OK, you could have just stopped at the whatever the screwdriver, the whatever the thing was that was in his neck. But you didn't. You took it an extra step more gruesome. And then you actually showed us like the splitting of him in half, like the insides of his body.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's a good point. And I know you brought up the, you know, the death earlier with her being very, very icy and cold. Mm-hmm. So that's a good trend.
I don't know. I'm an English teacher.
Look at that.
Picks up on the old motifs.
So as the butcher leaves the classroom, he encounters Millie and her friends and just starts screaming like crazy until the cops show up. And then, you know, the cops chase them out of the school. They get into Josh's very fancy car. So they're driving away and then Char sees them and tries to pursue. So to get away, they drive into a parking lot and run into the Discount Bonanza to hide, which is where Millie's mom works. So Millie hides in the dressing room. And then we have this scene between Millie and her mom, which is, I like the spirit of it. But it is ridiculous to think two grown adults would be speaking to each other through like a door for like 5 minutes and then just be like, yeah, my husband used to have nice, you know, get nice polo shirts and then he's dead now. And then they have this weird heart to heart. And I like that. Again, I like the idea of it, but it is honestly more ridiculous than any of the murders that occur in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, well, I've never worked back in retail, but like, I mean, Jason, have you worked in retail? Would you have a conversation like that with a customer?
Not retail. I worked in food service, so it all had to be pretty quick. There wasn't downtime like that. So, I mean, I guess if it's slow and you need to pass the time, I kind of get it. I don't know. I can't speak from experience, though.
From my experience, you don't want to talk to customers at any real depth. You might joke around with a customer to kill time, but you don't want to hear their life story.
John, at Best Buy, though, you guys were encouraged to be like hyenas. Like, I can't even walk from one end of the store to the other without 17 people asking me if I need help. I'm like, fine. Oh, yeah. I will come find you if I need help.
Yeah.
Like, well, I feel like Ron Swanson. I just want to be like, I know more than you do.
Well, I'll tell you this. One time, when I worked at Best Buy, the most awkward conversation I've had is this woman was talking about how her brother died recently.
Ooh.
She's been pretty upset about it and she's, you know, she needs a printer. But I was like, I was really failing to understand the connection between what does her brother dying have anything to do with having to buy a new printer to print stuff out? And I was like, oh, like you want to print out like photos from your brother and stuff? She goes, what are you talking about? And I go, what? So then she says, my brother, the printer brand, died. But like, she said nothing when I said stuff like, oh, I'm sorry for your loss.
That is a really weird way to phrase it, though.
And like, then to be mad, you know, at you, that like, how could you misunderstand me? I was clear.
When I worked retail, I wasn't very sweet with people. I was like nice and friendly, but I wasn't like, you know, if someone tells me something too serious, I'm like, whoa, I just work here. But like this woman, I thought she seemed like genuinely like going through something. Anyway, so that scene between the mother and the daughter, I don't fully buy it, but it does function in the way that it needs to mm-hmm. get that these characters, if only they weren't like,
well, it's like, and it plays into like the tragic nature of the mom's character and how, you know, I think a part of her feels like she is burdening her children, so mm-hmm. that causes her to open up to strangers. And then at the same time, Millie is now like realizing that her mom feels that way. Like, you know, this isn't just something she's like bothering us with. It's like really weighing on her to the point where she feels like she has to like talk to strangers about it. So I think it works both ways. In that regard.
So then it cuts to the butcher, and the butcher's playing was it air hockey, right? The one guy, I think it was Billy or Bill or something, Brad, I don't know, touches her butt, and then she like leans into his ear and just lets him have it, that she's like, you know, gonna kill him and whatnot. Then I guess there's this whole sequence that kind of builds up that the butcher and Booker are in like the mini golf course, and butcher's planning to kill Booker. And then just in the nick of time, the Millie shows up and knocks out both of them. Then they're at Josh's house, and Millie like wakes up Booker and explains everything. And she proves it by repeating a poem that she left in his locker that up until this point has never been mentioned once.
Mm-hmm.
And she repeats it. And I was like, I don't know. Like,
she has a lot of faith that he's going to remember what she wrote in that poem. Like,
yeah, actually, I saw a shot like in the beginning when he opens his locker and he has a piece of paper taped to it. So I was wondering, maybe it's just the class schedule. I don't know. But it looked like it might have been maybe the note that she left him.
Mm. Oh, interesting. Yeah, I didn't catch that.
So he believes her, and then they hatch a plan to get the, what's it called? Lodola. Mm-hmm. They're getting the Lodola out, right?
So Josh stays at his mom's house with the butcher. She's tied up. The rest of them go to the police station. They're trying to get the dagger. So Nyla, she goes into the station and she's telling Char that, you know, that they're held captive by the Butcher and he's outside because she's trying to get the dagger. So Char runs outside. So now they're in the car. We get the scene with Booker and Millie, and they are, you know, they're talking about how, you know, Millie's talking about how it's kind of like weird for her to be in like a powerful body for once, and you know that she feels strong, and you know we're kind of hinting at the themes we got at the beginning, like it's like, well, maybe the strength was inside all along, but she's now yeah. It's now physically being manifested. And then he's like, Booker just turns into like a really big cornball, like suddenly in this movie. And strength doesn't come from size. It's in your mind. It's in your heart. But he seems like a sweet kid. And he's definitely like not like he's, the other jocks in the film.
Apparently, he's the only sweet kid out of the football team.
apparently.
As we'll see later. Yeah.
So now we get this funny scene where Josh's mom comes home. She's like a flight attendant of sorts. And she had a canceled flight, and she walks into the situation where Josh is standing there with who she believes to be Millie, tied up in a chair
and gagged, you know, too.
And gagged. Yeah. And so there's this funny little bit where he tries to explain that they're role playing, and she's like, wasn't that kind of like a sexual thing? And then he gets this kind of moment where he's like, all right, mom, I didn't want to tell you this way, but I'm straight. And she's not buying it. She's like, you're a lot of things, but you're not straight. So at this point, the Butcher gets free, and there's this kind of chase throughout the house. We got the classic knife through the door shot. What I wonder is, so Josh is holding the door shut, and the knife comes through just past his face, right? And he continues to leave his face pressed against the other side of the door. Yeah. I always wonder in these scenes, like, maybe step back a little bit.
Yeah, a little. Yeah.
And distance yourself. Because, you know, if you go on one side of the door and you stab through and there's nothing, maybe you try the other side. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the Butcher is now starting to realize the limitations of having a smaller body. And, you know, she's getting kind of annoyed by all of this.
So he calls Nyla. Then the, you know, the camera that cuts to Nyla at the police station getting the dagger. And then Char comes back in, sees her taking the dagger, like, what are you doing? And then she pulls a gun on Nyla, which the movie
very aggressive move.
The movie would lead you to believe that Nyla has been like a close friend of her family for many years. And I'm just like,
because remember when she saw the Butcher like earlier on the field, like stabbing her own sister, she shoots the gun up in the air. Now that she's inside a police station with tons of stuff everywhere, and there's her, you know, her sister's close friend, the Butcher, and soon to be her other close friend of her sister's coming in, like all these different people, and you're gonna open fire and just, I don't know, like ricocheting, like, is that not a thing in this universe?
Well, I'll also say it's the optics of current day things that have been occurring about a cop pointing a gun at a young black girl.
Who's unarmed.
Who's unarmed. Not the greatest. Not good.
What does Char think she's trying to do? Like, weapon down. It's like still bagged up. It's not even like...
Like, she's in cahoots with the killer or something.
Like, you think that Char would be just more confused. Like, hey, like, don't open that. That's like, evidence.
All right, Nyla, you got to explain what's going on. Like, I feel like that would be at most. And if, like, Nyla tried to leave, you might be like, hey, wait a minute. Like, grab her. Be like, this to me.
Right. And
I'm confused.
Even with the over-the-top nature of the entire film, that scene doesn't make much sense.
And it seems like...
Like, what if Nyla didn't stop? Was she going to shoot Nyla? What the fuck?
And Nyla's trying to explain. Like, she's trying to talk and be like, I'm doing... And she's like, just put it down. And she's like, no, but your sister's in trouble. And like, and it's just so frustrating to watch at times.
Yeah, so then you have... while that's all going on, Millie and Booker, they share a kiss in the back of the car, and they're both a little freaked out by Vince Vaughn's giant hands. And they're like, all right, well, maybe we'll continue this at a different time. You know, this might be a bit weird. So while that's going on, they see Millie's body just run into the police station. So they all go in, and as Lauren was talking about, there's like a big shootout and all that. And it leads to the butcher taking the dagger, running off, and then Millie puts Char in a cell and apologizes profusely about it. Okay, so then we get to the big party at the end of the movie. The butcher's there. One of the football guys pulls him away, and there are two other football guys waiting. It's really weird, and the butcher decides to kill them all immediately, and it's brutal, it's awesome, and the best part is the butcher grabs a chainsaw and goes after like the main guy who's been kind of like messing with Millie this whole time, and looks like he chainsaws his crotch or something.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. And
that's exactly what happens.
But yeah, just to kind of go off of how we've been talking, like whatever you've done against Millie becomes the thing that kills you. So obviously the guy who's been like hitting on her and calling her names and such, the way he dies is by, you know, Millie's body having this very phallic looking chainsaw and then cutting at his crotch and cutting it out. So again, we just kind of have that repetition of the way you wrong her is the way that she kills you, or, well, Millie's body. I mean, it's the butcher, but still.
Yeah.
Very cool lighting in that scene, too. Mm-hmm. Very Argento-esque. Mm-hmm. You got all the neons.
I like that. I like when movies go for like that a different kind of visual palette than just like very minimal, like lighting, very dark. You can't see anything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is like bright colors, and like they really try to like make the scenes, like the locations they use are very interesting for these.
It's as stylized and as exaggerated as the film as a whole. So it works. If it wasn't that way, it would, you know, and it was all dark and really gritty and serious, it wouldn't play into the vibe of the film as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think it all works as, you know, a whole.
Absolutely. So then we see Phil talks to Josh and says he knows where Millie is. So they walk away into a secluded area, and then Phil tries to hook up with Josh, and Josh isn't into it. And then Phil immediately starts making slurs. And just after a certain slur is uttered, the butcher rips through and like hooks him in the eye and kills him. And, you know, that was fun. So there's like a big fight between Millie and the butcher. They're chasing after each other. And then as soon as Millie's got the dagger and is going to stab the butcher, her watch alarm goes off and it's 12 a.m. and she thinks, oh, she's too late. But uh-oh, pro tip, set your watch ahead 5 minutes, actually. So it's all good. Because the sweet boy told her,
yeah, watch ahead. So yeah, and Josh actually gave her the Apple Watch, and you know, we find out earlier in the film when Mr. Bernardi is berating her about being late. He's like, yeah, you know, pro tip, like set your watch,
yeah,
you know, five minutes fast.
Yeah, she stabs him. They switch back immediately, and the cops show up, and then Josh yells, shoot that motherfucker. Or shoot this motherfucker, something like that. I don't
know.
Can I
just say, I love Josh's character. Like, he is such a wonderful source of entertainment throughout the movie.
I'll say this. I think he was a little broad at the beginning of the movie, and then like the rest of it, I think he's very good. Mm-hmm. The cops at point blank range shoot the butcher, and apparently don't kill him. Very unlikely.
Or hurt any of the high school kids that are standing right behind him.
Yeah. Or just listen to a high schooler regarding who to shoot.
So, you know, the movie seems to be wrapping up, and then Booker and Millie are hanging out by the ambulance, and they get their real kiss, you know, and it's pretty, you know, it's pretty cool. I think they have pretty good chemistry in this movie. Mm-hmm. So they have that moment, and it seems like, all right, that's it. Everything's wrapping up just fine. Oh, wait, no, we have 8 minutes left. We have a whole other sequence. So then we have the butcher's in the ambulance. He wakes up, and you assume he kills everyone in the ambulance. And then it cuts to Millie at home. She's with her family, and you know, the mother's saying like, oh, I want you to go away to college. No, it's fine. I love you. Go free. You're free now. Go. And, you know, kind of just making literal all of the subtext of the movie up to this point. So
yeah,
they do all that, and then finally the butcher shows up and attacks Millie, attacks the other women, and apparently Char doesn't know that her gun doesn't have any bullets in it, and she's such a good cop that,
and she uses her gun all the time. So you'd think,
yeah, she uses her gun all the time, but doesn't, she points, can't it all tell. The time. But doesn't realize, oh, this seems lighter to me for some reason. Genius. Anyway, so they all take turns fighting him, and he's like berating Millie, mocking her and her anxieties and, you know, being weak and whatever. And then she impales him with a table leg, and he falls down, and he's dead. So, and then Millie declares that she is a piece. And then the movie ends.
Was that a callback to something that I missed at the beginning?
Yeah, so in the scene where she's walking in the school, Josh says something like, what are you talking about? You're a piece, Millie.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's not like very like memorable. So when she declares,
yeah, it didn't come off as cathartic as I feel like it was supposed to be. I was like, oh, that was probably a callback, but
yeah. Well, it's also weird to say that in front of like your mom and your sister.
And it hasn't really been like her strong motivation to be like popular or sexy or anything. It's like she seemed kind of just fine with her role. So,
right.
I don't know.
And there was nothing wrong with her before. It's just that she lacked confidence. Like that was really. And Nyla was trying to tell her, like, you can't do things for everybody else. You have to do things for yourself. So, I mean, killing this guy doesn't really, I don't know, prove that she now can do things for herself when she couldn't before.
I kind of wish the butcher had a as memorable of a death and a send-off as like some of the other characters. Mm-hmm. Like it seemed like kind of like an afterthought death, like, you know, we're running out of time in the movie, just like he gets impaled.
It's pretty bloody for that, for I guess for a like a normie like Millie to like do a murder, but
it is shocking in that regard.
So, and that she does it by her own hands, not like in his body or whatever. So
yeah,
I will say another little piece that I thought was interesting is that when the butcher is back in his own body and he's talking to Millie, that is the most he ever talks, is like in that scene. And I think it's kind of, my guess is, in the way that Millie learned from being in the butcher's body, the butcher kind of learned that he can, you know, talk and use like other methods than just being like just a pure killer. Like he would use his mind a little bit to mess with people, or, you know, whatever.
And it's interesting that he could sense her insecurities when he was inside mm-hmm. her body.
Yeah.
I thought that was an interesting element.
So up to this point, we've reviewed Peeping Tom, Psycho, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Black Christmas, the original Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, Scream, Behind the Mask, You're Next, It Follows, and the most recent Halloween. So how would we say this compares to like other slasher films?
Well, we already hit on the Scream comparisons pretty well earlier, I think. One thing that did stand out to me was kind of the similarities to the 2018 Halloween, how we kind of have this female empowerment theme.
Yeah.
And this kind of, you know, looking at the final girl in kind of a different light and kind of just reexamining her, and then adding other female characters around her, you know, in Freaky, we have the mom, and then we have Char, and we have Millie, and, you know, the mom is kind of dealing with like losing her male counterpart. Char is, you know, it seems to be struggling with trying to take this, like, you know, predominantly male career as a cop. And she seems just like really stressed out and on edge about it and just not sure how to handle it. And then we have Millie, who's like actually experiencing life in like a male body and, you know, getting a change of perspective with that. So, yeah, I just thought that was interesting watching it back to back with the new Halloween and kind of the spin on the female empowerment angle.
Yeah. And I think like you also have, just like I mentioned earlier, just being able to, like, when you add the body swap like formula to it, then you can have a little fun with, you know, a main character like in Millie's body. She can be like, you know, the final girl, but also like her body's killing all the people that have wronged her in the movie and whatnot.
Right.
So you get to have like a little bit of a wish fulfillment angle there too. So I think,
yeah,
you know, that adds add something to it. And
to me, it comes off almost more like a comedy first and then a horror movie second. Yeah. Which I think is like, because we've talked a lot about how the way it feels like high school kids. And I think that is so much more like accessible in that way, that it's like, here's the real life experiences that are like funny on their own, but now we're going to throw this like ridiculous situation into the mix and it's going to cause more chaos, but there's going to be some humor, some understanding oneself and kind of like finding oneself as well. And I think it just does a good job of blending different ideas together, mashing up different genres without it feeling like piecemeal or feeling like too detached from all these different things. Like, I think it does a really good job and it looks gorgeous too. So it's like, I don't know, it checks off a lot of different boxes.
So I got to ask the question, Lauren, would you survive this killer?
I think so. Yeah. If Millie, a 17-year-old, right? 18-year-old kid can do it. I've got a better shot than she does.
Okay. And you're probably a teacher in this scenario. And, you know, you're not going to be Mr. Bernardi. You're probably going to be one of the helpful, encouraging teachers of sorts. And
isn't there like a gym teacher in Carrie? I don't know. Does she die at the end? Maybe that's not a good comparison.
I mean, there a lot of people die at the end of Carrie. Well, all right. So, Lauren, you're surviving. What about you, Jason?
All right. Let's see. We always know the angle I take. Who would I be? And then what would my chances of survival be? I would probably be, I don't know. I don't like, I'm not like a high school kid. I don't think I would get killed in like, you know, just being like collateral damage to this. So I think my chances improve in that regard. I don't know. I hope I'm not like Char in this scenario. That would be.
I don't think you're a cop that just points their gun all willy-nilly at people you know very well.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm Nyla. Maybe who knows? No, I think I survive. I certainly wouldn't get into the body swap scenario initially, because I for starters, I wouldn't be a mascot. I just don't think that's a job I would have taken. And I don't think I would have sat there that long without a ride and just for the butcher to kind of find me. So I think I just kind of avoid the whole thing. Yeah. I don't know. I can't think of a scenario where I would die in this one. So I'm going to say I'd survive. What about you, John?
Well, here's the thing. I could see myself being like a mascot, actually.
See, I thought you were going to say I could see myself being a booker. And I was going to be like, really?
No. No, I have a little more self-awareness than that. I mean, Jason, you don't know this, but when I was in middle school, I was the water boy.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. They didn't have that role before me. I created it because I really liked the movie.
I was even going to ask. I was like, were you inspired by that?
No, I was inspired by the movie. And
I can't even imagine how much you quoted that movie in a season's time. You had to have quoted that entire movie in
all the time,
12-game schedule or whatever.
Here's the thing. I love the movie a lot, but I also liked not having to be a part of a losing basketball team that did very poorly. So I would go fill up the water and do other stuff. And like other teams were cool with me because they'd be like, oh, you're the water boy. And I'd be like, hell yeah, I'm the water boy. Did you see that movie? And they're like, yeah, it was really funny. And then like, we were cool. So
I can't believe you like made the high school come up with a non-existent
middle school,
the middle school come up with a non-existent role because you were so inspired by not even a top tier Adam Sandler movie.
That's amazing. Hold on. That is like top four, top five.
No, it's not even.
Okay, what's better than Waterboy?
Okay, Big Daddy, Happy Gilmore.
Yep.
Billy Madison.
Yep. And then the Waterboy's four.
No. Are we talking just comedy role? You got, what about Uncut Gems?
We're doing Uncut Gems comedies.
We're doing comedies?
Yeah.
I don't know. Give me a list. It's not in the top five.
Okay, it's Little Nicky's better? No. Mr. No. Deeds is better? No.
Yes.
Anger Management's better? No.
Mr. Deeds is better. Yeah.
No, it's not.
I might have to agree with Jason on this one.
No, you're both wrong. Anyway, I'm borderline a scholar when it comes to Adam Sandler's early work. So you're both wrong. Anyway, I was the water boy for the Milford Mules.
Just so you know, Milford only had one team. Like, they only had basketball. So, like,
there was nothing else.
No.
So if you wanted like to play a sport, you played basketball and that was it. So
no cheerleaders. Nothing.
No. They had to rename the Mules the Mustangs because that was easier than making the teams better. Like, like they were just getting made fun of way too much. So I don't even know what we're doing here. Okay, yeah. So
51st dates is better. Yes.
Okay, it's Waterboy's 5.
All right, I'll give you 5 on your list.
Okay, there we go. You were really struggling for that. Anyway, I could see myself in the position of accidentally getting stabbed and turned into Vince Vaughn. But in terms of, like, would I survive a killer? In Vince Vaughn's body... In Vince Vaughn's body... Why do I keep saying body? Body. In Vince Vaughn's body...
At midnight, John turns into a Jersey boy every night.
Anyway, if the killer is Vince Vaughn, I can survive that. If the killer's in Millie's body, I could see myself not seeing her as a threat. Yeah, and then just being like, maybe I say something sarcastic or whatever, and then just getting stabbed in the back or something, or horribly disfigured in some way. Yeah, I could see that happening. So, you know, half and half.
I'll buy it.
Okay. Anyway, that does it for this week's episode. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. Next week, we'll be doing our finale. Until then,
stab you later.
And it makes sense. Like, if you're peeing for the first time standing up, like, that's cool. Like, you're like, this is kind of nice.